start the first case this morning, which is Teresa Berge versus East Winds Court. On behalf of the plaintiff appellant, we have David King. And on behalf of East Winds Court, we have Mark Arndt. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your initial arguments, and then Mr. King, you'll have an additional five-minute rebuttal. You may proceed at this time, Mr. King.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I represent Teresa Berge and son Caleb Berge in this dog bite action. And what had happened is Teresa Berge was a long-time resident of East Winds Court. East Winds Trailer Court is an older mobile home trailer park in the county of Yankton. It's owned by John Blackburn, an attorney in Yankton. I believe there's 68 units. And Teresa had moved into the trailer park and lived with her three children. All three children are disabled. Caleb Berge, the young man who got bit in this case when he was 12 years old, he has been on an IEP his whole life. He has been tested actually, and he's in the very, very low range on every test. And he has severe autism.
Mr. King, I might just interrupt you for a minute. Could maybe you just speak up a bit? I'm not sure. You're a little bit soft-spoken. Maybe pull the mic a little closer.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Caleb lived four houses down from Ron Passman. Ron Passman had a large pit bull terrier named Marco. And he had that pit bull, I believe, beginning in 2014, 4 to 5 years prior to the dog bite. And I believe the dog bite was September 3rd, 2017. What happened that day, it was Labor Day. Caleb got up and across the street to play with some friends. And they went, did what they normally do, which is they then went down to Passman's area. There was a basketball hoop there, and the kids played basketball out in the street. And the basketball hoop, Passman's trailer's here. The basketball hoop is here. And Marco is chained where he's always chained, at the front of Passman's trailer. And he has a body harness on him, I believe even two. When Passman got Marco from his daughter, the first thing they did is they went out and bought two large commercial beware of the dog signs, and they nailed them right in the front of the trailer. The front of the trailer is mere feet from the common area, the road, the private road that serves the trailer park. So the boys are out there playing basketball as they've done many times before, and predictably a ball bounces into Passman's yard. Caleb goes to get it, and he is viciously mauled by Go, very viciously. He's had 8 facial reconstruction surgeries. He's had over 6 figures in medical bills. The shunt in his head was moved. He's had seizures ever since. It's truly a tragic case. He didn't start out with a lot, and he has less now. Lived at East Winds Court pursuant to a lease that had been written in part by Mr. Blackburn. And that lease provided at paragraph 13 that no dangerous or vicious dogs were allowed in the court. Marie gives the pit bull terrier to Mr. Passman. Marie couldn't keep the dog because she had it out on, I believe, Rosebud, and she couldn't keep it in the apartment because it barked too much. So she gives it to Mr. Passman, and he has it. And why did he have the dog? He testified he had the dog for protection. And I believe in my brief I cited a lot of the statements he made. You know, if anybody's going to come for me, they're going to have to go through my dog. You know, when the insurance adjuster showed up to take his statement, he told the insurance adjuster, "You're lucky my dog isn't here anymore. He'd have ripped you apart."
How would those statements that were made after this incident relate in any way to your argument that East Winds is subject to liability? And maybe as a follow-up to that, can you clarify, is your theory, Mr. King, that they had a duty, and so you've got this duty argument, or are you presuming a duty, and then you have a theory of liability that's a breach-based liability? Question is a lot there. I'm sorry, it's like three questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do believe they have a duty, and I think the duty's clear. I think that nearly every court that's analyzed it has found that if the landlord had notice of the dangerous animal, then the duty issue does arise. So I think the duty issue is met. And I think that summary judgment is inappropriate in this case. The case is about summary judgment. And importantly, the duty depends on notice, and notice is a question of fact. That dog was there for 4 to 5 years prior to this attack. Mr. Galvin, the property manager, he drove up and down that trailer park every day. That was his testimony. He admits that he saw the pit bull. He admits he knew about it.
So when you say they knew, help me understand. I mean, the general rule that we've applied before from 379, the restatement of torts, is that when a landlord parts with possession of a leased premises, the tenant may have some liability for whatever tortious conduct may be committed. The landlord does not, at least under the general rule. Of course, there are exceptions. Which one of those exceptions might apply here, or is there a different rule
that you would invoke? Thank you, Your Honor. Believe the general rule is found at...
Is that the restatement?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
379A, I think.
The duty of the landlord is identified in Lawson versus Kempfer, and it is that the landlord, having parted with full possession of the premises, is not subject to liability to a third party injured on those premises. However, here, Mr. Blackburn and East Winds Trailer Court never parted with full possession. They didn't.
I was wrong, by the way. It's 55. 379A was what they were trying to apply in clause. Forgive me. Why didn't he part with possession?
Here's why. Because he had a provision in his lease saying no dangerous or vicious dogs. And then he did nothing about it at all.
Was that provision for him? Or him, it, was that for the landlord, which is an entity? Was that something for their benefit? Or do you view that as a promise to everybody that the landlord will serve as the arbiter of whether a dog is dangerous or not, or should be there or not, and does so not just for the landlord's own sake, but for everybody out there?
Yes, I believe it was there for him and for everyone. I mean, it's written that way. It's geared that way. I think it was there for everyone's.
You haven't alleged that your client was a third-party beneficiary in any sort of contractual theory. And this is a private lease agreement. So why is it that you think that the landlord was assuming a promise that extends beyond this private agreement?
So
contractually.
So it was a month-to-month lease. So every month that Mr. Passman was there, from 2010 when he moved in to when he got Marco, Mr. Blackburn and East Winds Court had power pursuant to that lease to simply not renew his lease, to tell him on no uncertain terms, get rid of the dog. After this incident, they removed, I believe, 3, 4, 5 pit bulls from the trailer park. In other words, the landlord still had control. And I think, our case law comes down in part to that, you know.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. King, going back to the issue of notice, you talked about the property manager driving by the lot every day and seeing the pit bull out there. Is it your contention that just the fact that there was a pit bull there, that's sufficient notice, or are there other facts that you rely on to support your that the landlord had notice that this is a dangerous dog?
Thank you. There were two large beware of the dog signs posted right on that front of that trailer within probably 10, 15 feet of the road to put everyone on notice. I don't know what more Mr. Passman could have done other than take out a notice in the legals in the newspaper. He tried to warn everybody, and he bragged about it in the trailer park. You want to come for me? You got to go through my dog. He bragged about how tough that dog was. The neighbor certainly thought it was a very aggressive dog. And I think Mr. Galvin's statements are equivocal. You know, he says at the beginning their theory was the dog had only been there 3 months. How are we supposed to know? And that, of course, changed when the evidence came out that the dog had been there for 5 years. And Mr. Galvin says, you know, in 5 years you never saw the beware of the dog signs? I don't think so. I don't remember that. Mr. Blackburn, the same thing. You know, he basically makes statement that I never saw the beware of the dog signs, but if I would have, I would have investigated it, found out it was there for protection. I would have visited with Passman, and that dog would have been removed. But I think the whole guts of this case comes down to, you know, Mr. Blackburn saying, you know, I swear to God, I never saw that beware of the dog sign. And he testified, he goes through the trailer park at least 6 times a year. His son works there. He has an on-site property manager who goes by all the time, who claims he never saw the beware of the dog signs in 5 years. He went by thousands of times. I think a reasonable juror could say, you know, we do think you have notice. We do think you knew that it was a aggressive animal. And I think it's a fact issue. And I think it's inappropriate for summary judgment.
Counsel, the argument you're making is presuming that the legal standard that we apply here is not actual knowledge, but basically a constructive type knowledge or reason to know. Is that correct?
I think they had actual knowledge. I think actual knowledge can be proved with circumstantial evidence, and I think it's a jury question for the jury to decide. I think they had actual notice. Mr. Galvin says he went up and talked to him 3 months before when he first saw the dog. Oh, you have a dog. Yep, I'm temporarily taking care of it for my daughter. You know, and it was in the back and everything else. None of which is true. The dog was never kept in the back. It was always kept on that heavy chain right in front of the trailer.
So at least with regard to actual notice, it seems your argument seems to be that there are at least disputed facts as to that issue?
Yes, definitely. The neighbor, Miss Anderson, she believes that the landlord knew about it. Passman believes the landlord about it. They believe everybody knew about it.
But if you're resisting as you are, and in this case, a motion for summary judgment, and I'm sorry, can I have finish this up quick?
Go ahead.
As you know from our Rule 56 standards, incumbent upon the non-moving party to come forward with something that demonstrates there's a tribal issue on that. So what we have is that, you know, Mr. Galvin knew that they had a dog. The neighbor who said the dog, you know, lunged at me, the interview with the investigator after the fact, none of those precede the tragic incident that we have here. Those all came to light after. And so what tribal issue as a non-moving party is there that actual knowledge existed at the time, not later, not during the investigatory period, but at the time when this incident occurred?
Mr. King, your time's up, but you can answer the question.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Anderson's affidavit refers to the time prior to the dog bite. Mr. Galvin's statement, where he says, I don't remember. I might have seen it, but I can't say for sure. The beware of the dog signs. That if Galvin had knowledge, that knowledge is imputed to Eastwind's court, whether Galvin tells Blackburn about it or not. So I believe they did have actual notice, and I believe summary judgment was inappropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. King. Mr. Arndt, you may proceed. You have 15 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel, Mark Arndt on behalf of defense and appellee East Winds Court. I think analysis of this appeal in this case has to start with the reminder that this plaintiff consciously chose not to sue the tenant and owner of the dog that caused harm to her child. For whatever reason, and I'm sure we could speculate, it's certainly not part of any record on appeal, could be insolvency, could be lack of insurance, but in any event, the plaintiff made a conscious decision to sue the landlord instead of suing the owner of the dog. The circuit court granted summary judgment to East Winds based upon a lack of legal duty owed by this landlord to this plaintiff. And as this court is well aware and the precedent this court has issued many times, the issue of whether a legal duty exists is an issue of law for the court, not an issue for the jury. And primarily, the circuit court relied on two basic facts to make the determination that the legal duty was not owed. That first fact, which I think is dispositive of the case, I think both facts are dispositive, is that the incident occurred on the leased lot of Mr. Passman. It did not occur in a common area. And I think it would have to occur in a common area based upon this court's prior precedent of landlord-tenant law before the landlord would ever potentially become liable. It occurred on Mr. Passman's leased lot. There's no dispute of fact on that issue. Judge Knopf specifically found in his ruling, which you'll find in his opinion September 25th, where he entered an oral opinion into the record, that the incident occurred on the leased lot, not a commons area.
As I understand it, help me understand the lay of the land. The hoop sits on Mr. Passman's lot, but it kind of hangs out over, you know, sort of the street area, and then, of course, the ball bounced into the lot. But do I have that right?
Yeah, you do, Your Honor. Yes, that's correct. And I think it's also worth noting, again, not necessarily a decided issue in this case, but if for some reason summary judgment weren't granted or weren't upheld, there would be a lot more evidence about that basketball hoop, I suppose. But it's not as if East Winds put a basketball hoop out in the courtyard for kids to play and play basketball. I think the evidence would ultimately show that the basketball hoop was placed outside of Mr. Passman's lot by Mr. Passman and his grandchildren so that they would have a place to play. But this was not a situation where the landlord was creating a playground in an area that was near this dog. Sure, the street outside of the trailer home where everyone drives to get to their driveway should be considered a commons area, no question. And no question that that's where the kids were playing basketball. The basketball hoop sat, at least the base of it, on Mr. Passman's lot. They were playing basketball in the street in which the hoop overhung the road. The ball rolls, presumably the ball rolls off of the basketball court area into Mr. Passman's lot, where the plaintiff retrieved the ball and the incident ultimately occurred. But there's no dispute that it occurred on Mr. Passman's leased lot, not in a common area. And of course, the second issue or second fact that I believe is dispositive to the case is that East Winds was not aware of this dog, or at least not aware that this dog presented any danger to anyone. The court's questions of plaintiff's counsel are indicative of the lack of evidence in this case that the landlord was ever aware that this particular dog posed a danger to anyone.
Where do you put that awareness or that notice? Is that a duty question under, for instance, the 379A restatement argument that we confronted in Clausen, which incidentally has another problem because that not only requires actual notice, but it actually requires an off-premises, or contemplates an off-premises tort. But I see that as a duty issue, but this knowledge thing, I'm having a hard time understanding if that's presuming a duty to act reasonably, as was the case in the log cabin, the Roland versus log cabin case. And if that's the case, then that presumes a duty to act reasonably, and then the notice is whether there was breach or not, or whether the undisputed material facts indicate a breach. But I wondered if Roland wasn't a special relationship type case. They cite our decision in Small, and of course we've got a number of cases that talk about there not being a special relationship between landlords and tenants. So where does notice fit? Is that a breach question or a duty question?
Well, it's a fair question. I think it could be both, but let's take it from the perspective of the precedent this court has issued, including the Roland decision, which I think, to Your Honor's point, is correct. Of course, that's a special relationship situation. That's a bar owner allowing a dog into his bar, roaming amongst patrons in a retail setting that are consuming alcohol. That is completely different from a landlord-tenant situation and these particular facts. The Roland decision specifically says that the plaintiff in that case was a business invitee, and that, again, the defendant was the bar owner, not a landlord. This case is completely different. We have a young child who's a trespasser upon a leased premises. Very in opposite, I think, from the facts of this case. So as much as the plaintiff would like to rely on Roland for whether or not an issue of fact exists for a jury, the plaintiff can't get past the fact that the legal duty that's owed in this case is a duty for the court to decide, and given the landlord-tenant relationship, that legal duty doesn't exist. I think if we feather in the Ridley decision of this court from 2019, which decision made it very clear in an owner situation, an owner of a domesticated animal may be held liable for harm caused by their pet, but that's completely different, again, from the facts of this case. This is not the owner of the dog. This is not the possessor of the dog. This is a third party who owns and keeps the dog on a leased lot. It is not, we would be one step removed. As another example, let's assume in this case, suspend the facts of this and say that the incident actually did occur in a commons area. Even in that situation, according to Ridley, the plaintiff would still have to show that the landlord had knowledge that the dog was there or that the dog would be a problem. We don't hold landlords strictly liable in these situations for even an injury that occurs in a commons area. Our provision is that generally one party doesn't owe a duty to prevent a third party from harming them, and that doesn't change in a landlord-tenant situation. In order for the landlord to be liable in this setting, even if the incident took place in a commons area, the landlord would have had to have had knowledge that this dog was a problem. The dog's running around loose, barking, chasing kids, biting kids, whatever the situation may be, and the landlord has notice of that, then the landlord has potential liability when an incident occurs in a commons area.
And in this, in your view then, we have a no vicious pets provision in Passman's lease. That lease prepared by the landlord extended to Passman. And we have two large beware dog signs posted on the premises. Is that not notice?
Yeah, correct. I think it is not notice, Your Honor, or at least not sufficient notice that there's a problem. And I think it would be a dangerous path if we set some precedent and poor public policy to say that every dog owner who posts a beware of dog sign on their premises is therefore on the requisite notice that their dog, if their dog does in fact bite someone, cause damage to someone, that they're in fact liable for that.
Well, but that's different than if there's a fact question of, you know, rather than as a matter of law, they're responsible. Maybe that creates a fact question.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. That could create a fact question about whether or not there is, in fact, a legal duty from the owner of the pet to the injured party. But again, that's not the facts of this case.
So let me explore that a little bit. We've got, and this is, I know, a different area, but we've got cases in the employment context where employer, employee, and we talk about that when they have a duty to a third party, the employer, for their employee's acts. We talk about the concept of foreseeability in those cases. Is there a distinction between the employment relationship and a relationship between a landlord and tenant with respect to third parties?
I think there could be a distinction there, but I do think the foreseeability analysis applies to both settings as it relates to legal duty. This court has explored that issue before and has distinguished between foreseeability on an issue of law, on the issue of legal duty that would entitle a party to summary judgment, versus a foreseeability question that could become an issue for a jury to ultimately determine. I do think foreseeability enters into the analysis in both settings, but of course it doesn't change the fact that, at least in this setting and perhaps in the employer-employee setting, the legal duty issue is still an issue of law, and the court can determine it and needs to determine that. And the issue of duty is an essential element to any negligence claim, and there is clear precedent from this court and probably every state in the land that that legal duty issue is an issue for the court to decide.
But given the rule in 355 of the restatement, the general rule, again, which we've applied in our cases, before we get to just, it seems to me, a straight foreseeability question to determine duty, doesn't have to become disconnected from the general rule. Possession and control are critical in determining a landlord's liability. If the landlord divests itself of possession and control, do we even get to foreseeability?
Well, I don't think we get to foreseeability in the context of it becomes an issue for the jury to decide, but I do think foreseeability is built into the analysis of who owes a legal duty to another party, right? I mean, I hope I'm answering the court's question. Foreseeability regarding whether one party owes a legal duty to another in the context of a tort starts with the idea of, well, we don't owe a legal duty if the injury to the party is completely unforeseeable, right? So that analysis applies to this case just like it would any legal duty question.
But it seems like we have a, and I'm trying to figure this out, it seems like we've got a rule. It seems like we've got a restatement rule that says, as a categorical matter, we're not so much concerned about these individual case-by-case foreseeability questions where a landlord vests itself of possession and control. And that's a rule. And that may be some question about whether they have or they haven't, but that seems like a rule that defines a duty. And of course, you know, as Prosser says, I mean, this duties are that's judicial policy making to determine if someone's going to be held accountable and held to be subject to liability in order to conform their conduct to the law. It just seems like that's what I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what our rule, what that means then.
Well, I think the court can draw that bright line. And I hope I'm not making a counter argument to the court drawing that bright line, which I think it certainly could in this case. But I guess my point is that still goes into the bigger picture public policy analysis of what's foreseeable, right? I mean, in this case where the landlord gives up possession and control of the lot to the third party, I believe a matter of public policy we've said it's not then foreseeable that the landlord can be responsible to every visitor onto that lot who gets injured. Therefore, there's no legal duty that the landlord owes to that third party. Right. The landlord does not become the guardian of all things that happens on a third party's leased lot because it's not foreseeable to the landlord to prevent that type of conduct. It occurs to me, I maybe answer Justice Kern's question. I think she asked it about the lease premises. First of all, I believe any argument to be made that there was a breach of contract case in this case has long ago been waived. It wasn't specifically argued by the plaintiffs in their brief, and I think that argument has essentially been abandoned. Even if they did not abandon that argument, clearly the lease between the landlord and Mr. Passman, the tenant, is a lease that runs between two parties. It does not apply to Ms. Berge or her child. Now, if Ms. Berge and her child had a separate lease that provided some type of breach of contract cause of action for this plaintiff, that would be a different question. But she is not a party to the lease between Eastwind Courts and Passman. And just because there's a provision in that lease that says, hey, Mr. Passman, you can't have vicious pets on your property, doesn't provide a right to the Berges, doesn't provide a right to the plaintiffs. I should also note that that lease provision.
Your time's up, Mr. Arndt. I gave you a couple extra minutes. So.
Thank you. I was just going to make the final note that that lease provision does, in fact, provide, if you read it, the very first sentence, that tenants are responsible for their own pets. So the very first comment, even in that lease provision between Passman and Eastwinds, provides that Passman is, in fact, responsible. At the end of the day, again, the circuit court granted summary judgment for Eastwinds in favor of Eastwinds based upon a lack of a legal duty. That legal duty question's an issue of law for the court to determine. There was no abuse of discretion as it relates to the court's finding of those facts, primarily because there's no dispute that the incident took place on Mr. Passman's leased lot, not in a commons area. And there's no evidence in the record to indicate that Eastwinds was ever put on knowledge or notice that this dog was dangerous and therefore could have prevented this incident. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Arndt. Mr. King, you may proceed with your rebuttal argument.
Thank you.
Mr. King, I see your argument being, you tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, but I see your argument sort of being one that suggests to us, listen, don't apply this general rule. Don't apply 355. The general rule doesn't apply because this provision was a evidence of, and it's a contract. We can read the contract. this is evidence of continuing control, lingering control by this landlord. And so whatever the general rule is, this doesn't apply here because landlord had this contractual provision. And we've got to figure out whether that argument is right or not. Am I catching it right?
Yes, Your Honor. If I could address that, if you look at Claussen versus Kemper, which goes through that whole possession and control, the landlord rented, I believe it was a pasture in the Black Hills, on October 1st, 1987. Then they go to Arizona. 10 days later, somebody is hurt when there's a line going over a road. They get seriously injured. Landlord would have had no notice, and the court, invoking Section 355, said there's no duty here. When you further read Claussen, it talks about he reserved no right of reentry. Right on the face of the lease, it says we reserve the right of reentry. On the face of the lease, it says if you violate any of this stuff, you're gone. None of that's enforced. They had a lease. They just chose not to enforce it. Had they enforced it, we wouldn't be here. He brings up this subject of insurance. How come, you know, they sued the landlord, did not, you know, Mr. Passman? The lease says that Mr. Passman agrees to indemnify and hold the landlord harmless. Here, we had an on-site property manager for 5 years where the property was. I do believe it comes down to notice. Did the landlord know? And addressing the foreseeability point that was brought up, this statement is from Mr. Blackburn's own deposition, page 19, line 5. No, I can assure you, I did not see those signs or I would have taken action. What action would you have taken? Well, I would have investigated. Somebody puts up a beware of the dog sign, they have some knowledge that their dog could be a problem. And we're just not allowing problem dogs, then or now, if we know about them. So it comes down, did he see the beware of the dog signs? He, Mr. Blackburn, thinks that injury is foreseeable in this situation, but says, swear to God, I never saw him. And I think a jury is free to say, you know, in 5 years, with your property manager there, all day, every day, you still retain control. By the way, Section 355 of the restatement says the lessee takes the after possession is transferred. Then the dangerous condition occurs. Well, keep in mind, this is a month-to-month lease. So every time, Mr. Blackburn, East Winds Court, could have terminated the lease because the dangerous condition occurred at the inception of the month-to-month lease.
But even if you get beyond the 355 argument, don't you still have the problem that there's not a special relationship between landlords and tenants, as our cases have recognized? So how do you get to the Rowland sort of kind of situation? Because that was a business invitee and a business owner. We've recognized that a special relationship exists there. And in the end, that's what we're doing here. You know, you're extending the exposure to liability for someone who's not the principal actor, not the owner. So let's say you get around 355. Don't you still need a special relationship or something like that to invoke the rule that we indicated in the Rowland case?
Well, I don't believe so. I don't believe the landlord-tenant relationship in and of itself creates a special relationship. If you look at the cases cited
it
by...
It does not. We've held that it doesn't.
Right. It does not. If you look at the cases cited by a defendant in their own brief, the Toogood case... If you look at Alaska versus Smalley, all of them, the Nebraska case, if the landlord has knowledge of the dangerous condition, they just can't sit back and ignore it. And that's what they did here. They sat back and ignored it every month while that lease would be renewed. He had all kinds of opportunity, all kinds of power to go in there. Afterwards, he removed a bunch of pit bulls. He always had the power to do the right thing. Mr. Passman paid his lease, his lot rent, in one payment a year in advance. And I'm sure they liked that. But he had a very dangerous instrumentality on his leased premises. It is entirely foreseeable if you're playing basketball out in the street and he says, hey, we don't know all the facts on that. And if that's true, summary judgment never should have been granted. I don't think summary judgment ever should have been granted. I think it comes down to, did they have notice? You know, Mr. Galvin flat out says in his deposition, I can't say for sure. If you say you can't say for sure, how can you grant summary judgment? I think it is a question of fact for the jury to decide, not for the court to say, because there are facts in dispute. Mr. Blackburn says, I can assure you.
Your time is up. Thank you. We'll be in recess for 5 minutes.